Janie. Awesome. Right. We're in chapter 15 of John. Slowly making our way through. Getting there. We will finish this eventually. Leaping ahead with chapter by chapter. And what I want to do this morning is read half of it. And up to you whether you read along with me. I'm in the ESV version. Or whether you just want to listen. I want to see what you pick up in this first half. I want to get your reflections before we go much further, okay? So again, setting the scene, they're sitting around the table. Jesus is left now with 11 disciples because Judas Iscariot has already gone. And he's finishing off some of his key messages, if you like, that he wants to leave with his disciples, these precious few who will take the message on. I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit. Already you are clean because of the word that I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine. You are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit, for apart from me you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away like a branch and withers. And the branches are gathered, thrown into the fire, and burned. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish and it will be done for you. By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in love just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone would lay down their life for their friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you, that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should abide, so that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give it to you. These things I command you, so that you will love one another. What do you hear? Abiding and loving. You hear the word dependence. Okay. Though it wasn't said, you heard it. It's fine. I'm not criticizing. Yeah. Yep. ESV version. Yep. Remain, yes.
But to me, abide is the same word, the same sort of thing, as abode. And abode to me means to live with.
Hmm.
And so when I say abide in this, it means to live with.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what struck me.
Yep. So hearing the word abide, though not in your translation, makes you think of abode, a place where you live, where you remain, which is what is the word being used. Yeah, cool. Relationship. Hudson.
It seems to be this idea of connecting in the vine and getting all your source, asking for things, getting your life from God, and then giving everything away else, keeping nothing else from people.
Mm.
So you love people, you give up your life to people, you just give all that away, and then
Wow, this is deep. So the text sets up this movement where you draw all your life, all your wants, needs, energy, whatever, from God who is the source, and yet all that you're producing is given away as an expression or a way or a means to love others. Yep. Obedience. Cool. Yeah, Michael.
Understanding God's heart.
Can I ask, dare I ask how you see that? Yeah. So that the closeness, that movement of him and us and him brings us to a single focus and an awareness of his heart. Yeah, nice. Yeah, Jen. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. So you hear the tree of life, our ancestry is often seen and viewed as a tree and with branches, and from that comes the life of people and generations and so on. Yeah. And Jesus being the trunk, the center, the core. Yeah, excellent. Anyone else? Because right now you're preaching the sermon and I'm going to be able to sit down soon. Yeah. So you're picking up the kind of the danger in this of submitting to the Lord includes this snipping. And if you say, Lord, yeah, haven't we all made those prayers? Oh, maybe have we? If you're foolish like I am, you make those prayers like, Lord, I'll do anything. You know, just ask me. You know, or what is there in me? Like, you know, great David's great psalm. You know, what any wrong in my heart, Lord, expose it and bring it out and get rid of it. And then, as you say, Bernie, things turn to custard. And God says, all right. He loves those prayers, by the way. He loves those prayers. So be careful when you pray them. Lord, I'll do anything. Or Lord, what is there in me that needs to be refined? He's like, oh, yes, I've been waiting for this prayer. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yep, remain, remain, remain. Abide, abide, abide. Otherwise, you can do nothing. Yeah. Thanks, Graham. Yeah. So Jesus provides an example and moving toward the great example of what it looks like to be faithful to the Father, to abide in him and do whatever that might look like, but also that his death would have meaning. Better to die for friends than what other things might we end up dying for? Or perhaps living for more than other things. You know, we can live for our career, we can live for our family, and that doesn't seem like a bad thing, except it's often too small a thing. Jesus provides this wonderful example. And it's interesting, isn't it, how literal Jesus really is in this context. There's always a risk, I think, when teaching and preaching and even perhaps reflecting on scriptures, is to take Jesus' words and try and not take them literally. To not take him at his word in a sense. And he meant it. In his context, he was actually going to die. And that was critical. It wasn't I'm going to give my life I'm going to serve you and no longer seek my own ambitions or careers. He was actually meaning, I'm going to give my life. I'm actually going to die for this. Simplicity. Who said that? Oh, Rick. Yeah, yeah. Simple things are hardest. Yes. 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 Yeah. Yep. Yep. Yeah. His language is used the term circular. Often it goes in one direction, and then when you follow that, you curl back around and come back again. You know, if you're going to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. It comes, so then therefore love your neighbor as yourself. Well, how did we get back there? How did we get to that point of loving the Lord by loving someone else? How is it that we are to give our life to Christ only to find that he's given his life to us? How did that happen? But that's critical. It's critical. That movement is critical, and Hudson was picking up on it as well. Yes, Jen. Sorry, say again. For the love of. That describes the movement. Yeah, yeah, cool. As I reflected on this passage a little bit, one thing I am passionate about is wine, and I know a little bit about wine and the production of wine. I have with me here one of mine. It's a Friedrich Wilhelm Gymnasium from the Mosel. In Germany, it's a Riesling, 2001. We're not going to open it today. I wouldn't be allowed to, actually. We've got it under the property trust rules. I might not even be allowed to have this on site. Oops. But certainly, it's actually just water, and I've recapped it, and it's a very effective prop. But we won't test that theory. Now, the thing about vines is they want to go everywhere. You leave a vine to itself and it just goes in every direction. Have you noticed that? Has anyone got a vine and they've just thought, you have to keep trimming the things back, right? They just want to go everywhere. Toward the sun. They love the sun. They'll climb every tree, they'll climb every building, they'll climb every structure to get to the sun, but in every direction, across as well. They're just rampant things, vines. And they will produce grapes along those lengths as well. The problem is, if you're trying to produce great wine, those grapes on this, if you leave the vine to just go explore all directions and produce lots and lots of grapes, is those grapes aren't very good for wine because they're too dilute. They don't have a concentrated character. So what a vine dresser needs to do is start trimming the vine back. Like serious trim back, right? I mean, it's like a number one. To bring it right back and to produce just a handful of grapes on one vine. And potential for producing so much more, but it's quantity, not quality. So a vine dresser has to be diligent, persistent at trimming back all of this excess growth. And when they do that, with these few bunches, they can produce a wine so full of character and concentration, and with all this energy that the vine has to go in many directions, it pours it into then the few grapes it has, and they're so full of flavor and richness and depth that the wine you can produce itself can last for decades. If you try and produce wine from grapes that are dilute, they won't last long. The wine itself will be will fall over, we call it falling over. It becomes flappy and it doesn't taste very good. But a wine produced from grapes, from a vine cultivated over many years so that its roots go deep and that it's trained to produce just a few bunches of grapes, will produce wonderful wine. I was watching Seven Sharp the other day, and they had on it the one female winemaker on Waiheke Island. So that was the story. And the part of the story that I found fascinating was she was telling one of the reasons why she is so passionate about wine, the story that kind of is her story. And she had served in Burgundy in France, which is where they produce. I mean, I don't know if you know much about wines, but the old world, which is Europe, they produce wines related to a region, and the grapes they choose have been chosen over generations that work best in that region. Whereas what we do in the New World is we take that grape variety, let's say for Burgundy it's Pinot Noir, and we'll just plant that wherever we like. And we'll take Cabernet Sauvignon, which is in France is only ever grown in Bordeaux, and we'll grow it wherever we like. That's how we do it. But they produce wine region-specific, grape-specific to that region. And she tried a Burgundy made in 1945. Right, so this is not that long ago, not many years ago. That's an old wine. I don't know if you've tried a wine that is 60 years old, 70 years. Have you? And what struck me about this was she said she could taste the sadness in it. Now, she could be crazy. Possible. But she doesn't say that about every wine. For her, this was an experience where, it clicked. And she realized that wine was more than just grape juice fermented and put in a bottle. It was actually a way of telling a story, of capturing an entire, capturing all the elements that went into making that wine. Not just the grape variety, not just the weather, but also the people who made it are factored into this wine. And it's true that the better the wine, the more that it has been cared for and lovingly tended and produced throughout the whole process, it will become more and more unique and distinct, and that someone who has a lot of experience in wine can smell it and go, oh, I know what region this is from, and I possibly even know the year. And that's only possible if you can replicate that, right? Like if you can smell a wine and go, oh, I've smelled this before, it's from the Moselle, it's a 2001 Riesling. In fact, I can probably tell you the vineyard where that came from because I've got so much experience. Like that's only possible if the wine made in that area is so much a part of its character, has come from the special place and people and all that kind of thing, that you can distinguish it from all the other Rieslings from all over the world, right? Otherwise, it's a farce, but it's not, because there is training for this and people get qualifications for this, to be able to distinguish wines from different areas, different years. It's extraordinary. But it only happens if there is a vine dresser who is diligently trimming that vine. It only happens because that vine stays in the soil its entire life. And I think there's a reason why Jesus uses the word abide or remain or whatever else your translation says over and over again. I mean, he is, I think he says it 11 times in that text. Because there is a major difference between us and a vine. We can move. We can uproot, if you like, and go wherever we like. We can decide, I don't like this plot. I don't like these people. I don't like these conditions. I'm out of here. I don't like this Jesus or this God anymore. It's too tough. I might try something else. I think there's a reason why Jesus says over and over and over again in the context of the metaphor of a vine is that we vines can move if we choose. Therefore, we need to choose to abide. And is this true? Does this ring true to your experience that there are times that you wished you could move? You could. Has anyone ever? I mean, it looks so much easier being an atheist, for instance. I don't have to put up with, or I don't have to follow this. I could just do whatever you want. There are no consequences. There's no one measuring or. There's no standard anymore if you're an atheist other than what you choose it to be, presumably. Now, that's a very moral atheist. I'm not saying that they're immoral, but that's a choice of theirs, isn't it? Whereas for us, it's a sense in which I don't decide for myself what to follow or what I think is right or wrong or what I think is good and brings life and what I think doesn't. I'm no longer, if I ever was, the decider on that. The temptation to move, to find an easier path, it can be real, can't it? Abide, Jesus says. Abide, abide, abide. It's interesting, John picks up this word a lot in his letters as well. He phrases it, if you follow his commands, walk as Jesus walked, you will abide with him forever. And this is some more of the circular thinking of Jesus that's obviously impacted John. Jesus talks about abide to bear fruit, right? Seems to be the thrust of this particular metaphor. Abide in me and you will bear much fruit. In fact, you can't bear any fruit unless you abide in me. But if you abide in me, if you follow my commands, you will bear much fruit and the fruit will last. It will abide. It will remain. It'll be lasting fruit. It'll be wine that you can sell for decades and decades and decades rather than stuff that's dilute and will become flabby in 2 years' time and undrinkable. And then John takes that and says, and if you love him and you obey his commands, you will abide with him forever. Rather than talking about the fruit as being something that we might produce, he's talking about the fruit being living with God forever. Right? So we take this idea of, well, if I stick with Jesus for a long time, hang in there, something good will come of my life. Maybe an accomplishment. Fruits of the Spirit or something. There will be good things that will happen in my life because I've stuck with Jesus. And then John takes this, if you stick with Jesus, guess what? You'll have the eternal fruit of sticking with Jesus. Which I think is interesting. Because it's a bit like before, love the Lord your God and draw your energy and source from him and then pour yourself out into other people. And when you do that, it all comes back again. And if you love, or if you stick to Jesus so that you can actually be useful or produce something, the best fruit you'll get is that you get to stay with Jesus. Which asks the question, you know, what really then is God after? What does he want from our lives? What is this fruit that he wants from us? What is the best thing about sticking with Jesus? Sticking with Jesus. Yeah. Being with him. And the funny thing is, he seems to think the same. I no longer call you servants. I call you friends. Because you've stuck it out with me, because you are here still, we can be friends. Jesus seems to place really high value on that. And it's been costly for them to be there, and it'll be costly for them to stay there. One of the little illustrations that came to my mind was the decision I took to not stop my beard growing. Right, a guy doesn't grow a beard; he just chooses not to stop it growing. My beard's always growing, right? And I chose not to stop it. And caused some friction in my family, in my relationship with my wife specifically, who was not as impressed as I was with my beard. However, it was one of those most helpful conversations that we had in the context of this. Because we have the condition of faithfulness that holds us. That's our fundamental, right? We made a commitment, a covenant vow, which we're fortunate because we both hold to that. Now, I know that's not always the case. There are sometimes you go into a covenant vow with someone and they don't hold to it, and that's not your fault. But we're fortunate. We hold to that. That's our fundamental. And in that, we can have all sorts of robust conversations about what is good for us as a couple and what is good for us as individuals. Because in this talking about loving one another and the emphasis on pouring your life out for someone else, if that doesn't come back a bit, you can actually burn out, right? It's a risky proposition to love someone who will just take all of that and say, thank you, I deserve it. Do you agree that if you love someone who will not love you back, there's a real risk of burning out and of being abused, of being taken for granted, and it does happen. It's terrible to see it happen. In the context of marriage, the idea, I think, is that if I love Rebecca and try and do what is best for her, and she does the same for me, a beautiful relationship can blossom. But if I go into a relationship saying, well, I'm going to get what I can as best I can from this relationship, and she has the same attitude, there will come times when that will fall apart. That, well, this is not working out for me, conversation starts somewhere. So with this beard, and I did like it. I know it wasn't popular among everyone, and I know it wasn't popular particularly among women. I don't get that necessarily. Some did. But I had other men's wives coming to me saying, well, my husband wouldn't do that. He knows which side the bread is buttered on. Which fascinated me, right? Because I thought that the vow was to love one another, not to... not just I promise to groom him and make sure he's well presented in the world and that he will do as he's told. I didn't think that was the covenant vow that I'd made. But it seems to be the case that the covenant of relationship, of marriage, there was always a beard when she made the covenant. Absolutely there was. I just kept on cutting it back. It's part of me.
You didn't realize you were committed to coming back, did you?
No, it wasn't in the fine print that I would continue to cut, that I would continue to desecrate what the Lord had given me. I wasn't aware that that was in the marriage contract. To honor and obey. No, that wasn't there either. Yeah, well, yes, there was an expectation I would continue to cut it because I had at that point. You could also argue there's an expectation I'd remain 23, but I'm sorry, I'm now 43, and I can't hold some things back. What was good about this conversation, though, was because it forced us to think really clearly and carefully about what it is that we thought that we were getting into. And it was only possible because of this commitment we made to abide, to remain. Right? If you don't have that commitment, then you can't have true and honest and genuine conversations about what your heart needs in life. Now, I'm coming to this from the angle of Jesus says, ask whatever you want, and I will do it for you. That your joy may be full. Like, Jesus' whole point in this isn't that I am the Lord and I just love it when people do as they're told. That's not his point. His point is, if you obey me, your joy will be full. Mine and yours. Ask anything in my name, it'll be given to you. And that gets tested in relationship when you want something and the other person says, I'm not sure, or I don't know, or perhaps not. And there are differences within the realm of God, because he can give some things that my wife can't give. There are things that the Lord is capable of accomplishing in our lives that my wife can't do. But there's something in this discussion between, you know what, I really want this. And for her to come to me, well, I really don't want you to want this. That is healthy, but can only be done in the context of this abiding relationship. Because I fear that often as Christians, we think that we're not allowed to want things, that we're not allowed to have desires, that we're not allowed to bring our full stuff to the table, that we're supposed to be sort of anemic, pallid, kind of, I'm just doing what Jesus says, and I have no other desires but what Jesus... Like, God doesn't want that. He doesn't want weak-willed, lily-livered, pathetic people. He wants full-blooded, rich humans who know that they want things. And that this context of God, this relationship, you can ask anything in his name. And we won't give anything if it doesn't fit with the relationship, right? Lord, I just want to worship something else. Do you mind? Well, that's dumb, right? Like me asking my wife, do you mind if I date someone else for a while? It's stupid. If you ask something in his name, though, you're saying, Lord, in accordance with this relationship, that my connection with you matters, and I know that your connection with me matters, and that you care about me, would this be okay? Could I take this job? Or, Lord, we need a new car. Can you provide? What should we do? Please give Rebecca a love for beards. Yes, Bernie. Amen. Why didn't I think of that? Or did I?
But suddenly you get to a point where, well, I'm not sure as I need the beard anyway.
Well, thanks, Marshall. So in this conversation, what Rebecca and I both went through was this kind of question of, well, what in this relationship, what do I really, really, really want? Right? What do I really want? Do I want just what I want? Right? So from Philip, it's I want the beard. For Rebecca, it's I don't want the beard. So when we're in a position of, okay, now I'm acknowledging what I really, really want. Half a beard, no thanks, Julia. And I did a moustache, and that was awful. I looked like I should star in some kind of movie, and not a good one. When that's important to recognize, actually, there's needs and desires and wants in my heart. That's important. That's what's called being human, and it's good. God puts desires in our hearts. In fact, God gives us desires. But then comes the pruner, and wants to prune those down. Say, good, you have desire, you have energy, you have a drive, you have a will, you want to go somewhere, do something, excellent. But you can't do everything. You can't want all things. You can't live with all things. So let's just trim you back to love one woman or one man. Let's get these grapes down to some really good, concentrated, awesome quality stuff. So just love one woman or one man with all your heart. Devote yourself to that person. And this stuff will last. And, oh, you also have other desires for things. You know, I don't just want in my life to have a deep relationship with my wife. There are other things that I love. I love music. And I want to express that somehow. And there are some things I want in context to music that I'm bringing to the Lord and bringing to my wife. Can I have this? And if in the conversation we say, no, it's not going to happen now, or if the Lord says, let's check on that for the moment, so be it. But I'm not going to set aside the wants and desires. I'm going to allow God to prune it, and I'm going to ask for them in the context of the relationship I have with my wife and the Lord. The one is fidelity, that is abiding, that is a remaining, that is, in the end, what matters most is that we stick together, not that I get out of it what I want. So in the conversation that we had, I decided I'd have the beard only for a year, and then I'd cut it, and I wouldn't go back to it. But I would have it for the year, and my wife... And I had to accept the fact that my wife didn't like it. I had to leave her with the, I don't like it, and I don't have to, and give her that permission. And she had to do the same for me. I don't own you. We are in relationship. I am not your owner. I don't like the beard, but you can, if that's your choice, you can have it. So we negotiated an ability to... Marshall, you've been desperate to say something.
Yeah. No communication, but the more you're relating, the more this person's wants become part of the wants that you have, and you think, goodness, yes, if wearing the black suit reminds her of someone that mistreated her, there's no way I should be wearing a black suit. Let's forget it. That's, you know.
Yeah.
In other words, your greater self adjusts to something that is consistent,
isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. If we really deal well in relationship, and when it's a context of fidelity and remaining and abiding being the most important thing, the safe container that will keep us together, so that we can discuss these yearnings, desires, wants. If, as you say, it's in a to and fro, back and forth. What is good for you? What is good for me? I want to do what's best for you. I will give you license to do some things that you really need because I see that's good for you. That might cost me, but it's good for you. But if it's something painfully costly to me, I'd hope you'd do the same too. Yeah, absolutely. And that's how we get pruned, right? That's how these things get cut back. So it's no longer just whatever I want to do. It's not just a yearning for the sun or to climb any building or to see anything or have anything. It's if I want to be of value and of worth, more being not just many more grapes, but actually more being better, richer, denser, more concentrated. And then I won't read it because I don't think we've got time, but then Jesus turns bizarrely to say, and you know what, because of this connection to me, the world will hate you. And I've often wondered why that was the case. And I've often wondered why do people really hate Jesus? He wasn't a bad guy, was he? Everything I see, he's just so good. There's probably a lot I could say, but all I'll say is this, to wrap it up, because I'm aware of time. Someone really wisely sort of described our current culture, ours particularly, as being like a rebellious teenager. It believes, you know, like a rebellious teenager looks at the parents and goes, your way of living, you're stuck in a rut, you're boring. I mean, these rules that you have to have dinner at 6 o'clock, sit at the table. Who cares? Who needs it? Why? Go to church. Why bother? What's the point of all these rules that you live by? Culture has, in a sense, sort of done that to Christianity, which has raised it and brought it this, you know, democracy and slaves, freedom of slaves, and the ability to vote for women. These things have come out of a Christian tradition, and yet it now looks at that tradition with a sort of a sneering mockery, like, ah, but you live by rules. I mean, you've got all these rules for sex and for marriage and for children and for... You're so bound by rules, and it sneers a little bit like a rebellious teenager. Wants to throw off all of those rules and live like the vine that has no restraint. Just wants to have everything, reach out and grab all things. It doesn't want to be restrained. And I think when it comes down to it, largely that's the rejection of the world to God. I don't want to live your way. I want to live mine. I have all this energy. I want to have everything and grab everything. And it doesn't recognize it. And in doing that, it destroys the things of most value. It becomes dilute, diffuse, and burns out and overreaches and lacks substance in the end. And the only way to come to a mature substance, something of worth, something worth laying down, and the parent that it's sneered at has had to work through the same stuff that the teenager has had to work through. I've got these incredible drives, and yet in marrying someone, I now need to curb those. To this one person, you know, having to make this choice, I now need to stick with this one person. And I had all those drives you had too, but I've tried to train them or had them allowed to be trained so that I can have a good marriage, not just so they can have lots of sex or whatever it is that you want. So I think culture generally and the spirit of the world largely is always going to be pushing against. It's going to be consistently wanting us to have more than is good for us. Wanting us to just break free of things that we think are restraining us because it doesn't want us to be deep-rooted, faithful Christians. Yeah, I think I've done disservice to the last part of this chapter, but as I said, I'm aware of time, so I'll wrap it up there. Where's my phone? Before I do close, there's a couple of notices that I want to share again and remind us as well of the God stories. There are things happening in your life, I know. Things that God is doing. And we are trying to capture them, record them, mark them, honor them, so that we can be, all of us, encouraged about what God is doing in our lives, individually and corporately. And this little mechanism here is basically, if you've got a story that either you don't want to share or you've yet to share or whatever, take a milk bottle top from this vase and put it in the jar, and there we are counting up the numbers of God's stories that have come in. I know from, you know, people talking that there are a lot more stories than are accounted for in there. So please, do your part. If you've got a God story, sometimes you don't want to share the one that, you know, something's been going on in your life, you know God's been part of it. You don't want to share it by, you know, having other people read it. But if you take a token and put it in there, then it's acknowledging that something's happening in your life that God's part of. No, you don't have to write on the token at all. It's just a way of counting it. Yeah. So at the end of the year, we might be able to say, you know what, this is how many stories that we had this year. You might. No one has yet. No one has yet. Right. A couple of notices. Next Tuesday, or this coming Tuesday, the 9th, the Hamilton Christian School are putting on a Stations of the Cross event from 6:30 to 8:30. So that's Tuesday the 9th, 6:30 to 8:30. And it's there's no program. There's about a dozen stations, I believe. So, and you can just go in whenever you want within that time frame and look at the stations and then go. So there's no program to that, but between 6:30 and 8:30, Tuesday night, Stations of the Cross, the Hamilton Christian School. And the Sunday night coming up, not tonight obviously, but the next, we're going to have an Easter worship night So 7:30 to around 8:30 will be, so it's pre-Easter, because I know, you know, often we go away and half of my worship team will actually be in Easter camp anyway, so it's pre-Easter, but a chance to reflect and to sing some songs and to celebrate Easter. So that's next Sunday night, so I'd plug that as well. Oh, thank you. Yeah, Good Friday. Every year we join with other churches in the north of Rototuna with a Good Friday celebration. 9 a.m., I think, is the carrying of the cross to the top of the hill. It's to Hugh Hugh Park or something like that. Toi Toi. There will be instructions closer to the time. So there's the carrying of the cross from 9 to 9:30, top of the hill, and then the ceremony, the service at 9:30 in the morning for an hour or so. And so it's a combined service, if you like, and just literally show up. If it's raining, it'll be held at Northgate Community Church. But as I said, we'll have more instructions to that so you know exactly what we're doing. Right, let me close with the blessing. Ma iho a koe e manaki, ma na koe e tiaki. Ma iho e mea kia tia hatona mata kia koe. Ma na hoke koe e atawhai. Ma iho a tono kanohi e whakara kia koe. Ma na ano e tuku te rangamari e kia koe. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May he make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May he lift his countenance upon you and bring you peace. Amen.